In this episode of the Smart City Podcast, I interviewed social scientist and design researcher Laura Filano. Laura and I had a really great discussion about socio-technical aspects of design and how humans and machines come together. Laura talks about a number of her projects, ranging from driverless technology to reimagining work and going back in history to think about technology. She is also very passionate about the active engagement of citizens and rethinking the way we do this engagement through design. We also discuss about the differences in imagined futures of technology versus the reality. As always, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
It's the Smart City Podcast, whoa, with Smart City experts, here we go. Connecting smart technology, both big and small. Smart cities are making life better for all. Big data, emerging trends, self-driving cars and more. The Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hi Laura, how are you going today?
Great, how are you, Zoe?
Yeah, pretty awesome. Well, let's just jump straight into it. And can you just tell us a little bit about your background and what you're passionate about?
Sure. My background is that I studied communications at Columbia University and graduated with my PhD in 2008. And around that time, between about 2003 and 2008, I was working closely with community groups to build their own wireless infrastructure and participating in a group in New York called NYC Wireless, and then also meeting with lots of groups around the world in cities like Montreal, Budapest, and Berlin, learning a little bit about community-owned infrastructure, and at the same time studying the ways in which we use these technologies. So that's what got me started on getting interested in the ways in which technology, and in particular, at that time, wireless networks, broadband networks, and municipal networks were part of the infrastructure of the smart city. And since then, that's really expanded to include a lot of other technologies as well, which we can certainly get into. And I identify very much as a social scientist going about qualitative research into the socio-technical, the ways in which humans and computers, machines come together. But I also work as a design researcher at the Institute of Design at Illinois Institute of Technology, where I often will use a design approach to learn about these same questions. And that might mean a participatory format or a speculative design format, and finding multiple ways to learn about the relations between humans and machines.
Yeah, awesome. Was there anything in particular that sparked your interest in smart cities?
Well, I think that one thing that was really nice early on was the feeling of, while I was studying these relationships, I was also participating in groups that felt like they were doing something really different and unique, which was, using Wi-Fi network, Wi-Fi networking technology to build community-owned networks, and that was really more of an activist orientation. So it felt very pragmatic and applied in some sense. And so I think that that feeling of being able to intervene in these technological questions and understand the politics and the economics and the social relations, and that was pretty much what sparked my interest. And since then, I've done lots of projects where I've tried to use different formats to engage publics around those same kinds of issues.
Yeah, cool. Do you want to talk about some of the projects that you've done in the past?
Sure. So one of my more recent projects has been on the driverless city. This was a 5-person team at Illinois Institute of Technology funded by the university's NIAR Prize. And that was a $100,000 grant that was given to 3 teams at the university out of a total of 53 teams that applied. And we had a 1-year project that looked into driverless cars, autonomous vehicles, driverless test beds, tried to understand the ways in which we might shape these technologies, and in particular conversations that are taking place in cities around the world about the implications of these emerging technologies. So for that project, we actually developed a series of 4 videos which you can see on the website on the Driverless City. And these videos are expected to not predict or project a particular future, but to highlight important questions that we might be asking about technology before we adopt it into our cities.
Yeah, cool. That sounds really interesting. I can put the links to those videos in the show notes for sure, so people can check that out. Okay. Yeah. So do you want to talk about any of the other projects, or would you like to talk about what you're currently working
on? Sure, I can talk about some other projects. Another current project is one called Made in Chicago. That one looks at local manufacturing, and in particular, some of the organizations that often when we think about the smart city, we do tend to highlight the work both of top-down organizations such as city agencies or technology companies, and we also tend to look at activist networks and often, you know, hacker spaces and maker spaces and their role in using particular technologies. And in this new project on Made in Chicago, we're trying to look at the ways in which these top-down and bottom-up activities might intersect in important and interesting ways, and also trying to understand whether or not the more bottom-up kinds of activities that are taking place among communities and in some of the more organic spaces might be used to imagine and understand alternative ways that the economy of a city like Chicago might be restructured. So that's one of the current projects. Previous projects. I think that relate to this topic. I did a project a couple of years ago called Reimagining Work with a colleague, Megan Halpern, and we held a participatory design workshop in which we tried to look at the ways in which social and economic justice organizations were thinking about emerging technology, in particular robotics, artificial intelligence, and algorithms, for example. We looked 3,000 years into history, and we tried to understand the ways in which technology had been invented and used throughout history, and in particular to highlight the fact that technology itself is a product of human creativity. And so the idea there was to use history as a speculative space in which we could invent alternative understandings of the relationships between humans and technology. So, for example, in that game that we played at the workshop, the game would give you a situation like you're a fisherman in ancient Greece. What kind of worker campaign, you know, would you invent in order to improve the lives of fishermen? And so that game, which we played together with social economic justice organizations and technologists and local designers, business people, and government leaders in the Chicago area, allowed us to open up some of those conversations and questions about the ways that ethics and values and responsibilities are embedded into the technologies that we design. And following the playing of that game, which took about 2 hours, we actually then had a short prototyping activity. And the prototyping activity allowed us to invent and imagine alternative technologies that might support workers today and improve the outcomes, improve the economic chances of people that are currently doing, you know, for example, minimum wage jobs in fast food restaurants or other kinds of labor. So we were trying to reimagine technology and reimagine the agency that we might have in shaping technology towards alternative economic models than the one that we are currently operating within.
Yeah, cool. That sounds really interesting. So where do you think that America kind of ranks when it comes to smart cities?
Most of my research being very qualitative in nature and in recent years focusing in particular on cities like New York or Chicago, I don't tend to think particularly on, you know, sort of which cities are ahead or behind. I think what's interesting is really the ways in which discussions around smart cities are often being shaped by many different forces, and that includes major technology companies and governments, but also includes civic technology organizations and activists. And I think what's really interesting is that rather than a broad universal application of the same technology around the world, which you could argue would lead to very homogenous kinds of ways in which these technologies are playing out, I think you do really have a lot of local geographies that are appropriating and shaping some of these smart city technologies in ways that are unique in their cities. And I mean, one example there certainly might be the Toronto project, which, you know, Google, the corporation Google, but known as, you know, Alphabet often in this context, or Sidewalk Labs in particular, is essentially building a city from the internet up, they like to say, in Toronto. And in that particular smart city example, they're actually having a series of open hearings and meetings that seem to be hosted by the company in order to better understand the positions and politics of that local community. And so I think you see that what is a smart city and what kind of smart city technologies you have and how they're appropriating certain cities is going to differ. And often a lot of the arguments that you hear being made by government or by industry are also shaped by the more activist-oriented groups or by the civic technology conversations. And so it really is really just a mix of really many different forces that are shaping what happens on the ground in any given geography.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting way to think about it. And I agree. I think not about comparing city to city about, you know, I've got this much tech and you've got that much tech, but it's actually about using tech appropriately to enable that livable kind of area or space.
Exactly.
Yeah, cool. So,
and on the one hand, it does seem, of course, that cities are trying to entice people to want to live in their city by appearing to be tech savvy. And obviously they're seeing this as a way to attract citizens. But at the same time, they're also reshaping those technologies according to their own needs.
Yeah, definitely. So where do you think good places are to pilot this smart technology?
Well, I think good places, you know, where you have active engagement of citizens groups that are really interested in pushing back again on both government and on the companies, I think it's going to make more sense. So this Toronto example is quite excellent because Toronto is known to have a history of really active social organizations and nonprofit groups and activists that work on environmental issues and a range of other issues. So it's a very vibrant community. And so far, it seems like with these early meetings that they're having, you know, they've actually had to move to bigger venues in order to accommodate everyone. So I think that's a really healthy sign that people really want to get involved and they do want to shape the way that project plays out. I would actually worry more about the places in which primarily government or corporate actors are going to control, you know, most of the decisions and where they're not actually involving the community. Because I think that's a recipe for a really bad outcome and one where you don't really learn much about what works vis-a-vis the citizens in your city.
Yeah. How do you think we can better integrate across the disciplines, you know, government, community, and industry?
Well, I think that's one reason that I'm interested in using design methodologies, because cities, of course, are accustomed to having a variety of formats for citizens to engage. So, for example, voting on referendums or showing up at a city council meeting and giving a testimony or having a town hall meeting. And you know, over about 10 years ago, when I was actively working with the community groups around wireless networking issues, I did testify in front of New York City Council. And I was also actively involved in the National Federal Communication Commission's community representatives groups as well. And I think that, you know, while all of those formats can be productive and useful, they're very much skewed towards having a verbal exchange about the issues. And I think it's very difficult for the broader public to participate in those formats. Not only does it require a lot of time to write testimony and show up at a meeting and deliver that testimony, or to arrive at a town hall meeting. And that's why I'm really interested in the ways we might use design to create prototypes or experiments that can engage people in a more visceral and experiential way in what it might be like to live with that technology, and then be able to solicit feedback, perspectives based on those experiences.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. A lot of engagement, I suppose, is expecting community members to show up and do a lot of work on their behalf. Whereas I think, particularly the younger generation, but probably everybody, we all have less time to do things, and really we want to get involved, but it's a bit difficult. So I think the easier we make it and the more accessible and more different avenues that we have, there's such potential to get a better result and much higher engagement.
Exactly. And that was the reason that we actually used video as one format for the Driverless City project, is because in a 3 to 4 minute video, which you can post online, you can potentially support people to, watch that and give feedback in the form of, kinds of questions would you ask about this kind of future scenario. You might have a very visceral response, whether positive or negative, and that's the purpose of some of those design interventions.
Yeah, cool. So do you think America already is leaders in this space? Or if I suppose America's a very large country, but certain players in America are already leaders in this space?
Yeah, I do think that many cities, and often it's not the bigger cities that are able to lead, because the bigger the city, the more complex the technology rollout might be, and more expensive as well. And so often bigger cities like New York or Chicago might actually take the lead after they've seen some success in a smaller city. But we do see that all around the country, similar vendors with similar kinds of technologies are certainly showing up, on the street corners all around the country. So examples of that might be the Big Belly trash bin. So this is a solar powered trash bin that decomposes some of the garbage inside the trash bin by using solar technology, but then also has sensors inside, and it can notify the garbage trucks when the trash bin is full. And so then the garbage trucks can come around and only pick up the trash, at specific times, rather than having to drive around every day on the same route. And that technology we've seen, now roll out in many cities around the country. You will see that familiar Big Belly trash bin. Other examples might be, now that there's these Link NYC terminals, which are providing internet access that are have been created by a consortium of three companies, one of which is Sidewalk Labs, so AKA Alphabet or Google. And the other cities have been adopting those as well. I think London has a version of that project as well. I believe right now it's still in a pilot phase. But that technology actually received a lot of pushback, in particular around privacy issues and what kind of data from citizens would be collected if you do choose to use the free Wi-Fi on that system. So that's another example. There's some other technologies like dynamic pricing for parking meters or the red light cameras in Chicago. So I think, different cities have a different assortment of technologies and systems that they've adopted. And often the bigger cities are going to wait to see if something is tested before they adopt it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I suppose the smaller areas are a bit more nimble, so they can test out some things, and the bigger cities can learn from their, for want of a better word, failures or learnings and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there are so many different technologies. So if you think about driverless cars, some of the locations that are currently talked about where there are test beds include University of Michigan's campus, and they're planning to build a test bed for driverless cars 10 times the size of that in Michigan. There are also some pilots of Uber self-driving cars in Tempe, Arizona, and then Pittsburgh recently also, you know, featured a pilot of that sort. Certainly around Mountain View, California, where Google's headquarters is, there was Google's version of the self-driving car testbed. So if you talk about the driverless city as a technology or as a testbed, you'll look at certain regions and certain cities. But then if you look at other applications, other cities might come to mind.
With the driverless cars, and you've spoken a bit about that, I'm interested to hear your views about the potential social change for autonomous vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, so certainly, I think one thing that's interesting about having a public conversation around these technologies years or even decades after, before we start to decide whether or not to adopt them, is to try to understand whether people might be amenable to, you know, riding in driverless cars, or are people still very attached to the idea of driving, you know, because of its, you know, symbolic relationship with things like freedom and, you know, when one gets their driver's license, which was a generationally very important, you know, for, say people 10 or 20 years ago, but may not be as important to, someone who's getting their driver's license today. So there are going to be changes that relate to age and demographics and regions, you know, in the States, if you live in a rural area versus an urban area. And then also the driverless car combines many different technologies within it. So it has sensors and, you know, wireless networking, and there are different kinds of models. So some of them rely on communicating with infrastructure, and others, most of the technology is in the car itself. There are cameras, LiDAR, GPS. So each technology that you look at, that's part of this greater smart city conversation itself is a, you could say, bundle or assemblage or, sort of a network of many technologies that are relying on one another that relate to both hardware and software and networks. And so it's really important to bring together not only the technical expertise about all of those technologies, but also the social expertise, from fields like design and sociology and anthropology to understand how people use those technologies, how do they understand those technologies, how do they engage with them, and then looking at specific communities or demographics. So, for example, in particular with the driverless car, often communities of disability are talked about as being beneficiaries of this technology. On the other hand, there doesn't seem to be any particular auto manufacturer that is specifically designing for a particular community with disabilities. So, for example, for the blind or for people with mobility and access issues, or for deaf communities, for example. So it's very interesting, and one of my biggest interests is really the way that we imagine these technologies and what metaphors we use and who we claim they're for, and really the dissonance or the disjuncture between some of the imagined futures of technology and the lived experience of the realities.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting way to think about it. I really like the bundle of technologies together. It's not, we talk about autonomous vehicles as one thing, but really it's so many things coming together, working together. And also, yeah, who is the smart city for? And do they know it's for them as well, which is an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah. And I wrote about this recently with respect to the red light cameras in Chicago, because what was so interesting is that over a period of about 5 years, the red light cameras, as reported mostly in the Chicago Tribune, which did a lot of excellent reporting during that time, illustrated the ways in which that particular technology, which was ostensibly adopted in order to help the city of Chicago enforce traffic laws and ostensibly to prevent traffic accidents that were occurring at specific intersections, when in reality, due to a number of problems, but including corruption and disobeying city of Chicago laws, disobeying federal transportation guidelines, deploying in areas that were not those that were high in accidents, and also the social acceptance or the social adoption aspects, which resulted in the end, you know, with a very problematic technology in which the city eventually had to pay about upwards of $30 million back to people that they had issued tickets to. And the fear of driving through these red light camera intersections actually resulted in more accidents because people would actually back up into the people behind them. So really, you know, it's very difficult to predict what a technology might, what kind of social relations, economic, political, ethical relations might occur once that technology is adopted. So I think that's a really interesting case that I wrote about recently for a platform called Public Books, in an article called Invisible Algorithms and Physical Politics.
Yeah, cool. I'll put that in the show notes as well so people can check it out.
Great.
What are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about at the moment?
Oh, that's a really good question. I mean, when you look at a lot of these topics, you can often feel like you're both ahead and behind the conversation. So in that sense, there are, you know, certainly with something like driverless cars, on the one hand, it is in the mainstream media almost on a daily basis in terms of what will happen when we adopt these, how will it impact the economics, how will it impact commuting. At the same time, only certain cities have actually seen these cars driving through their spaces. And at the same time, there are, you know, going to be a lot of regulatory issues even to adopt these technologies. So while in the US, the government has verbally and through finances actually supported, you know, claims to say that they will support the rollout of these technologies with $4 billion in government investment. At the same time, there are still going to be a lot of challenges and negotiations to actually adopt those technologies in any given city. So I think it's very interesting because it's difficult to place any specific city or any even technology on really a temporal framework. We'll love to take a guess of, you know, whether or not we're going to be changing our transportation habits in 20 years or in 30 years or in 50 years. But what we do see is glimpses of potential futures, or preferable futures or plausible futures. And what we need to do as, citizens is to get involved in asking and pushing back about the particular kinds of futures that are being offered by the government and by the corporate, sort of, investments in the sectors, around smart cities, and actually try to understand what is the real value and for who might this serve, and make sure that we can build up, networks of activist groups and citizens and neighborhoods so that we can, continue to, participate in the shaping of these technologies.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I only have one last question, which is, how can people connect with you?
Sure. So my website, laurafrolano.org, is always a great place to start. And I'm at the Institute of Design at Illinois Institute of Technology. So also, some of the project documentation is there on the website for the university. And I tweet, at Twitter at Laura4, L-A-N-O, and also at critfutures.org. Which is the Critical Futures Lab, which houses most of my research.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I'll put all those links into the show notes. And yeah, it's been really great to talk to you.
Great talking to you as well.
Enjoy sunny New York, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Okay, sounds good.
See you, bye.
It's the Smart City Podcast. Whoa.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart City Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes can be found at thesmartcitypodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for me or any of my guests, connect with me via email, zoe@thesmartcitypodcast.com, or via the socials. I'm on Twitter and Facebook at Smart City Pod. As always, I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed making it.
Smart City Podcast is what you're looking for.